Representative Charles Rangel, Democrat of New York, member of the House Judiciary Committee, and chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Representative Andrew Young, Democrat of Georgia, former executive vice president of Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. From Washington, D.C., Issues and Answers, the award-winning interview program. Brought to you by Exxon.
These men are doing something about the energy shortage. And so is the company they work for. They're oil men, and their job takes them 30 miles out into the Gulf of Mexico. As important as their work is, it's only a small part of Exxon's effort to supply more energy. Exxon has initiated the largest development program in its history. Over the next 4 years, Exxon plans to spend $16 billion. Most of this money will be spent to find, develop, and transport oil and gas in the U.S. and around the world. $16 billion is a huge investment for a single company. But considering America's energy needs, it's a necessary one.
Twenty years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed public school segregation, a decision which set off a revolution in race relations in the United States. Is there progress toward equal rights today? What effect has Watergate had on the civil rights movement? Will the House impeach President Nixon? For their answers to the issues, our guests will be interviewed by ABC News commentator Edward P. Morgan and ABC News correspondent Bill Matney.
Welcome to another edition of Issues and Answers. And this is 20 years after the very historic Supreme Court decision. And 20 years later, there are contradictions. One body of opinion holding that momentum for total equality has come to a halt. And the other contention, advanced recently by black political scientists, that black political progress has been enormous. Where are we at this point, Reverend Young?
Well, speaking from the South, we have had a genuine revolution that's far more comprehensive than anybody can imagine. I've driven across the South a lot in the last few weeks and months, and driving by schoolrooms in Alabama and Mississippi and see the schoolyards totally integrated in the rural South. In fact, the very place where we organized the Selma to Montgomery March, there was a Little League baseball game going on this Monday with blacks and whites playing on the same team. And I don't think court orders had anything to do with that. But at the same time, I think when you look at the national picture, there's some questions to be raised. Let me go back and say politically, the South, too, has moved phenomenally. I think 14 new state representatives were elected to the state legislature in Alabama on Tuesday. We've got the possibility of 25 in Georgia, 22 in South Carolina. That means a whole new level of leadership, which helps the South turn the corner.
Roy Wilkins, the executive head of the NAACP, has been quoted as saying that The disillusionment is complete in terms of racial progress as it relates to the North. Now, are we talking in terms of economics? Are we talking in terms of progress in school desegregation or integration?
If you're talking about civil rights, I have to agree with Andy that the progress is being made in the South. Unfortunately, many of the liberals and labor leaders that was so anxious to get down there to Selma thought that the civil rights only related to the blacks and whites in the South, but when the vibrations started to be felt up North, they resented it, and they still have. It seems to me that things have hardened. The Wallace-Nixon type of thinking has taken away the spirit of people in hopefully living together, both black, white, and brown, in the society. of course, coming from the Harlem community, once you have these fixed-in inner-city black patterns and you have deteriorated housing and you find that there is no escape from it, you can have all the brown decisions you want, but unless you break up the housing patterns and make it possible for people to live where they want, then, of course, you can't have an effective integrated school system.
Congresswoman Jordan, is it possible that the white majority is being beguiled a little dangerously by these figures, these indices of enormous progress that your colleagues have been talking about? 20 years ago, it would have been impossible to hold this program because there wasn't that array of black members of Congress. We now have a black member of the Supreme Court. We've had a black member of the cabinet. What I'm getting at is, do these things that translate as progress still seem tokens to a lot of black Americans?
They are still tokens, but white America is not only being beguiled by these figures, many black Americans are also being mesmerized by the figures of progress. You only see the visible evidence of black achievement. You don't see those who have not achieved. America does not see on Issues and Answers that large hundreds of thousands of black and brown citizens of this country who still have not reached that level of equality. If you look at Brown, its implications are certainly far beyond whether black children go to school with white children. The Brown decision was more than anything else the landmark of change in race relations in this country. But racism is still there. Now, I'll tell you a figure which we don't quote very often. Take the years 1971, 1972, just that brief period. 1.5 million whites moved out of low income into middle income. In that same narrow one-year period, 477,000 blacks moved into low income. Regression upon regression. And if I quote that figure for 1972, it is worse in 1974.
So let me ask any of you, what are the areas most critically needing a push and a shove? Is it economic? Is it education? Is it political? Or is it all three together?
Well, let me jump into that and say that we made significant progress socially. We're making progress gradually politically, but I think what Congresswoman Jordan is talking about is an economic retrogression. And that's what the present leadership has done for us.
Meaning the national leadership?
The present national leadership did away with the climate of repentance in race, the positive attitude toward a nation which would put itself beyond racism, and in fact began to exploit the racist fears of the majority group, polarized this nation in order to get elected, and contributed to the general moral climate which we now find ourselves in, in which nobody gives a damn about anybody, and everybody's just struggling and clawing, trying to make it for themselves.
Bill, I was going to ask this question later, but it's apropos right now on the basis of what you've talked of politically. Why did Governor Wallace last Tuesday get such a large percentage of black votes? If my figures are correct, it was 25% of the total vote that he got.
You have to see, I'm really not, there's not time to quarrel with those figures. But the only reason he got any black endorsements was that he had no opposition. The newly elected county commissioners and mayors have to go to him to get state funds. For 4 years, it's inevitable. And they gave him a kind of lip service in order to make peace to survive. I just don't see Wallace with any political power in the South anymore. The other thing is that the white leadership in Alabama has not emerged and has not developed as it has in Texas, in South Carolina, Georgia, Florida. There's moderate white leadership, even in Mississippi. It's not in Alabama because the Wallace forces have consistently crushed white, intelligent leadership that has tried to work with blacks.
I'd like to get back to the question of the impact of the Nixon administration policies on civil rights progress. The president maintains that blacks have prospered under his policies. He points to the commitment of monies to black colleges. He speaks of monies that have been committed to black businesses. He speaks of high-level appointments within the government.
He does.
Under the Nixon aegis.
If I can only hear the president speak about those issues, it would be enlightening. I haven't even heard him lie recently about his concern for the plight of blacks in this country. The Congressional Black Caucus has monitored his State of the Union messages. We listen attentively to every speech that he makes to the nation. And his honesty is his indifference to the sensitivity of poor people in this country. And as Ed has asked earlier, which area do we need the most help, social, economic, or politically? When you're talking about powerless people, I think Andy Young put his finger on it. It's the climate in which we live and the lack of moral leadership. President Nixon has made bigotry, which at one time someone was ashamed to talk about it, a very popular thing because you were more in line and more in tune with the administration. So that certainly with any progressive legislation that the Democrats in the Congress has come up with, the president has been against it. But Bill, I just haven't heard the president lie lately about his concern for black and other minorities. He politically had decided where his strength was coming from. He astutely determined that it was not coming from the black and brown communities. And he just ripped us off in terms of a response.
What has been the impact, Congresswoman Jordan, of the Nixon administration policies in the overall thrust of civil rights, of the movement that was generated in the 60s and apparently now has kind of ground to a halt, with the exception of the political progress that we've already noted?
There was an outcry, as you can recall, when Mr. Moynihan first talked about benign neglect. And even though we do not see people say those words often anymore, I would say that that has remained consistently the policy of this administration. There is the question as to whether neglect is ever benign or can ever be benign. But suffice it to say that black people have been in a role of the non-existent as far as the focus of this administration was concerned. There has not been any concentration of effort to deal with black people as a reality issue, racism as a reality issue on the part of this administration. It has been ignored. Black people have been ignored. Now, I don't want to leave the impression one moment that nothing has been done in terms of progress for some black Americans. It depends on whether you're an optimist or whether you're a pessimist. The glass is either half full or it's half empty. What we're saying is it is still half empty, in spite of the fact that we have some 3,000 elected officials now and some money has been put into programs which may inure to the benefit of black people. That inuring to the benefit of black people was accidental, if at all.
Congressman Rangel, I think you had a footnote you wanted to add to Ms. Jordan's statement, and then I want to ask you a question about, of all things, politics.
As Barbara said, we can't run away from the progress that have been made with more elected officials locally and on the national level, but this had very little to do, if anything, to do with the federal administration, because they've been elected, for the most part, from black communities that in the past have not had the opportunity to register and to vote. And I'd just like to say in conclusion of that point is that Mr. Nixon was elected from the so-called silent majority and arousing their fears and believing that he would no longer give special attention to the black minorities. And I think we're finding now that middle America sees that they, as minorities, have been neglected by this administration.
My question to you is, and anybody that wants to answer it as well, please do. We may or may not have a President Ford before 1976. What do you judge to be the black reaction to Gerald Ford as a politician, as a potential leader of the country?
I don't really think that the blacks would be any more different from most Americans in saying, who in the heck is Gerry Ford? Gerry Ford is one of the few people that have been down in Congress for a quarter of a century, and his only recognition was his ability to lead the fight to have Adam Clayton Powell, my predecessor, unseated, as well as to unsuccessfully attempt to impeach Justice Douglas. I think that Vice President Ford really shows that anybody in this country can become vice president. But if we concentrate as we have to on the public transcripts and concentrate as we are on the judiciary as it relates to who is the President of the United States, I think that Gerald Ford and his honesty and his lack of controversy will be just a breath of fresh air for the nation.
Well, you've mentioned the Judiciary Committee. How do you assess the importance of Watergate in terms of the black political constituency in this nation? Are blacks concerned about Watergate?
Blacks are concerned about heat, hot water, getting jobs, unemployment, and the Nixon administration, well, from the very beginning, has shown its indifference to that. I think that perhaps Andy and Barbara can add to what this could mean politically in the southern states as we attempt to pick up the pieces and move forward politically, because there is a gap there.
Let's say what Watergate is, though. Watergate is milk that's $2 a gallon. Now, every black family that was paying $1 a gallon for milk 18 months ago is concerned about Watergate every time they go to the grocery store. And for my family, that's every day. Every black family looks at 80% of the items in the supermarket having their price raised as a result of the Soviet wheat deal. That's Watergate. Black families are being destroyed, literally, by unable to get to the far-reaching jobs because of the conspiracy that went on around the so-called energy crisis. And all of that's Watergate.
And yet you can't, not being a lawyer, check me, you can't impeach a president because the price of milk under his administration was doubled, or the price of bread increased enormously.
Oh, you can impeach a president. I'm not speaking as a member of the Judiciary Committee, but when he sits in the room on a certain day, and when there is record of his conversing with certain dairymen, and when they receive a $25,000 contribution with a promise of $2 million to come, and then a few weeks later the price goes up, as far as I'm concerned, that's an impeachable offense. I don't know what
As a lawyer, we have more to deal with than just that. But I think in what Andy is saying, when the president indicated in his public transcripts that he could get $1 million, that would be no problem. I think whether you're a lawyer or non-lawyer, you know that you have to sell a piece of government to get that $1 million.
Do both of you, as members of the Judiciary Committee, think that you have got all the evidence you need on that specific case, the milk case?
I don't know whether we're in line here.
No, we have no evidence on the milk case at all at this point. We have requested some documentary evidence from Mr. Nixon by letter of the counsel to the Judiciary Committee. That letter was sent out on the 19th of April, but it has not as yet been responded to. And Mr. St. Clair, the President's counsel, made the statement that they were still open to negotiations on additional information concerning ITT and the milk deal. But let me get back to the question which Andy and Charlie addressed themselves to. I think that black people in the main cannot feel viscerally that the occupant of the White House will make their lives any easier when it comes to education, jobs, housing, wages, health care, or all the plethora of issues which plague and dog the lives of black people every day. Not one of us seated here could tell you that the removal of Mr. Nixon from office would suddenly bring about a reversal so that black people would then have food, adequate housing, health care, jobs, wages, and the rest of it. That is altogether unclear. As a matter of fact, it has been said that his successor in the White House, Mr. Ford, would take even a harder line in terms of the role of government in domestic problems and domestic issues than Mr. Nixon has taken.
What about a Democrat?
Well, a Democrat is certainly not in the future for the next 3 years.
I'd like to take a little issue with that, though. I stuck my neck way out for Gerry Ford once before.
Spiritually, though.
Yeah. Everything that I have seen of him or said to him since then indicates to me that he would want to. Now, whether he can or not within what's left of the Republican Party, but it would seem to me that the only hope...
Want to what? Do
want
what?
To move toward rectifying the image of the party as an oppressor of the poor. Now, whether he can do that amidst the big business and special interest forces that control that party, I don't know. I think that he would want to. I also have the feeling that the difference would be in the present administration, the only possibility of survival is going to be a further exacerbation of racial tensions over busing. Nobody had said a word about busing for I don't know how long until the president started a couple of months ago, once again reviving the old busing thing. Well, that's something to stir up people again and maybe get them to turn against. Well, it's part of that old divide and conquer routine that has characterized the campaigns of 1970, 72, and it would look like the only hope the Republicans have. Now, I'd like to quickly hasten to say that the Brown decision was not for black people, that the Great Society programs were not for black people. Watergate is not in any way for black people. White Americans are culturally retarded and unable to face the future, the kind of world that this world is, unless they have some experience with black people and learn to relate to people who are of other colors and other cultures. They have profited immensely. And the progress we've had in the South has not been administrative progress. It's been people realizing that they needed something in their lives. They're going ahead after it in spite of political leadership trying to lead them to the contrary. I think the same thing is going to be found to be true of Watergate. Watergate is going to free America, not just black Americans, when the president is impeached. There will be a new spirit.
Well, that's
the
question
that will have to emerge.
That's the next question. What is the sentiment? Are you in a position to gauge the sentiment the Judiciary Committee?
My answer would be that when Vice President Ford becomes president, in all fairness to him, he will have, notwithstanding his 25 years of indifference, and certainly he was not in the forefront of the civil rights movement. But unlike the incumbent, the vice president will have the capacity for growth. I don't think there's any question that both Republican and Democrat in this country and in the Congress believe that it is time to change. We are restricted on the judiciary from commenting too much publicly until such time as all of the legal evidence is before us and until we make our formal a report to the House of Representatives. But the people are making the decision because while they say the House makes it, the 435 members go home every weekend and they are feeling the pressures from their constituents, and that is America.
Perhaps you can all three judiciously respond to this question about the proceedings. The White House has tried to draw a very narrow definition of impeachable offenses. And Mr. Dorr, your majority counsel, has tried to draw a broader one. Could I ask any of you to say what your own definition of impeachable offenses might be?
I have no difficulty saying that. I agree with the report of the counsel of the Judiciary Committee. I do not feel that an impeachable offense has to be an indictable offense. I do not think it has to be one which shows criminality committed by the public official while he is in office. I agree with the definition, which is a part of the conclusions of the committee report, that an impeachable offense can lie for gross abuses of power by a public official and gross neglect of duty.
And even if you accepted Mr. St. Clair's unconstitutional but narrow viewpoint, I'm convinced as a former assistant United States attorney that based on the public transcripts turned over by President Nixon, that he could be subject to indictable offenses by his conduct.
Let me go back a little further and say that John Doerr tried most of the civil rights cases in Mississippi and Alabama in the early 60s. He was trying cases against admittedly racist judges, and I don't know that he ever lost a case. And so when he brings to this committee a document, he's going to have his stuff together. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't have any compulsions about making judgments on this. I remember being around a group of my conservative Republican colleagues who had just come back from a White House breakfast, and they were trying to reassure me that Agnew was innocent, and that they were rallying support for him, and at that very moment, Agnew's lawyers were involved in plea bargaining, and before 5 o'clock that afternoon, he had resigned. After having breakfast with his own friends and colleagues, assuring them to the contrary.
I have to interrupt us all, or we'll be impeached because time is out. Thank you all for joining us on Issues and Answers.
Thank you.